then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is May 22nd, 2022. I'm Jimmy, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
The valley's like the man, she's lonely croon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
My name is Harold Covington, and this is the third and final of a series of commentaries I've entitled The Ghost Dance. When the American Indians of the late 19th century faced extinction, even as white people do today, they believed that they could perform a huge act of ritual magic called the Ghost Dance that would raise the spirits of their mighty warrior ancestors from the dead so that they would return to Earth and fight the white man and destroy him, as the shattered and demoralized remnants of the Plains tribes were no longer capable of doing for themselves. Because dead warriors cannot be restored to life, and living enemies cannot be destroyed with magic, the ghost dance failed them as it will fail us. Today, we white people are the ones who are facing an existential threat of genocidal extermination through the abolition of national borders and uncontrolled immigration, but also culturally, economically, and politically. The incoming Donald Trump presidency will be only a historically brief breather. At best, a short Indian summer, maybe, before the long nuclear winter of our extinction. And it may not even be that. It could be that President Trump will simply betray us from day one in office. Or it could be that through no fault of his own, he simply won't be able to restore any kind of order at all, and the whole ball of wax just crumbles into pieces. Now, as wonderful as it's been for the past several weeks watching the liberals shriek and tear their hair and rend their garments, I keep having to remind people that this is a battle won, and not the war. The enemy is still intact and on his feet. The reptilian creatures who want us all dead are still out there, circling like sharks, and already they're planning their return to power. And many of them, government bureaucrats and officials and media swine and university professors and so on, never left power at all. Like the Indians, we are responding to this imminent threat with our own version of the ghost dance, wherein we resist the physical invasion of our ancestral homelands in Europe and North America by hordes of mud-colored people with words, but not physical action of any kind, legal or otherwise. We're trying to beat off an existential threat by posting pictures of guns and Vikings and historical emblems to social media on the internet as if millions of black and brown bodies can be repelled and returned whence they came with pictures. And at the rate Twitter is canceling alt-right accounts, we won't be able to do that for long. We too are summoning the spirits of our warrior ancestors to do our fighting for us, so that we ourselves will not have to undergo the terror and the fury and the danger of actual combat against armed enemies who want us dead and who might hurt us and interfere with our pleasures in life and generally inconvenience us. Most of you will already have heard the first two parts of this Ghost Dance series, but let's run down the usual ritual disclaimers first, wherein I try to cover my ass with a fig leaf so that everybody can maintain the pretense that I'm not saying what we all know I am saying. The fact is that we now live in a land where men are sent to prison for words alone, something that was never supposed to happen in America, but there it is. I'm sorry to see the grand old First Amendment go by the board. It used to be the jewel in this country's crown. Who knows, maybe under President Trump it will bloom once again for a time. Anyway, I'm not trying to incite anybody to commit acts of violence in the sense of Dylan Roof-type hissy fits. No, really, I mean that. That kind of thing is stupid and suicidal and pointless because it affects no change at all and usually generates all kinds of bad PR. If you are absolutely determined to destroy yourself, go step in front of a bus. I'm tempted to say that I'm not trying to incite anybody to break the law, but since what is legal and what is not has now become so hazy and taffy pulled out of any relationship with reality that law, like everything else, has now entered the entirely subjective and post-factual era, and it's all about the narrative, like everything else, well, there's not much point in my trying that. Legal and illegal is now no longer a matter of fact or law or truth. It's a matter of interpretation. It's whatever some political gangster in a black robe says it is. I am harmless. My ideas are not. I'm not threatening anybody. I'm threatening everybody. I am threatening to change an entire social order and turn it upside down so that the first shall be last and the last shall be first, as I believe it says somewhere in the Bible. And that's always a dangerous thing to attempt. I'll just have to see how that plays out. Okay, are we all clear on that? Are we ready? Then let's begin. One of the most notable features of white nationalism, the so-called alt-right or whatever the hell you want to call us, is that we are constantly discussing, analyzing, stating, and restating the problem. Almost never is any actual solution to the problem ever mentioned, and even when it is, it's always in the most vague and tenuous of terms, often in ways that we already understand perfectly well to be ineffective and absurd, ways that have proven that they don't work. Someone once said that the definition of stupidity is doing the same thing over and over again and yet expecting a different result every time. There you have 75 years of white nationalism encapsulated in a single sentence. Often we know that our so-called solutions won't work because they're just more of the same old, same old. Now, one of my favorites is networking, which these days almost always means nothing but internet. We've all just got to network enough, and millions of dark-skinned foreigners will simply disappear from the land, and the niggers will go mumbling back to their shacks, and Eisenhower will be back in the White House, and Cindy Lou the cheerleader will be back in her bobby socks. We can flop down, pick up the remote, and see what's on the tube tonight. Or for you younger guys, I suppose it would be some idealized memory of the 70s or 80s or 90s, maybe with MTV and Pac-Man. I used to think that white people were just really, really naive, not to mention dumb as a bag of hammers, but we're not. I've come to the conclusion that virtually every man and woman who becomes involved with us very quickly understands what we should be doing, and when we do, we either turn and flee like a gazelle running from a wolf pack, or else we spend a large part of our political lives in an elaborate tissue of denial, because we don't dare do what we all know we should be doing, and yet we can't bear to simply sit there like lumps and take the blows that Obama's America rains down on our heads. And yeah, Trump or no Trump, this is still Obama's America, and it will be for any foreseeable future. Any idiot can turn an aquarium into fish soup, but it's damn near impossible to turn the fish soup back into an aquarium, and that's what Donald Trump will be attempting to do. The purpose of these three little ghost dance talks of mine is to try and bring you to the point where you will take that fearless and searching moral inventory of yourselves I spoke about in part two. You will make a rational and informed decision to change, and you will do so. You will deliberately, as a conscious act of will, alter the very kind of man or woman you are. You will transform yourself into someone that your great-grandfather would have recognized. You will then begin to take direct action in order to bring about change. No, That is not a euphemism for violence or insurgent asymmetric warfare against the dictatorship, although that's certainly one form of direct action. There are a number of entirely legal ways of taking direct action for change, beginning, of course, with the act of homecoming. But all of them involve some degree of inconvenience and personal risk. The inconvenience of changing one's own lifestyle and routine, the risk of financial loss or contraction, and more significantly, the risk that you will, in the course of things, be exposed to the public gaze as being different, as being an outsider, not of the body, to use an old Star Trek term. For herd animals like white people have become, that is a terrifying concept. That's the first thing you need to grapple with inside your minds. You must come to accept that if you are going to do anything effective that will help bring this horror show to an end, eventually others are going to find out about you. Granted, there are a few people who really do assist this cause from positions of secrecy and concealment. I know some of them. The chances are virtually certain that you're not one of them, and that for you to be in any way useful and live up to your duty, people will eventually find out who you are, what you are, and some of them will be bad people who will give you hassle. The white boys have been taught all their lives to run away from conflict. We're going to have to reverse that little bit of social engineering. One of our many serious problems is that when the majority of people get into contact with us and try to get involved, their first consideration above anything else is to continue to hide. Now, that can be done up to a point, and I myself usually facilitate this as much as possible because the party is so desperate for help that I have to take whatever I can get on the conditions it's offered. And usually those conditions involve allowing and assisting someone to keep on hiding their political and racial deviance from others, spouses, parents, and above all, from their employers or whoever gives them money. Nor is this fear unreasonable. Yes, cutting off a white man's money and taking his stuff is how the dictatorship maintains discipline and the outward conformity and consensus which is so vital to maintaining its power. But things have now reached the point where what we require of you involves a good level of likelihood that other people will find out that your mind's not under control and that you're thinking bad thoughts in your head. Some of those people will attempt to bully you or intimidate you or do actual harm to you. So, you let it happen. You accept it. You are a soldier and the enemy is going to shoot at you. Comes with the territory. This new man or woman you're going to transmute yourself into understands that the decision to do something about all this is dangerous, and that there is virtually no chance you are going to emerge unscathed. You are going to lose things, maybe some of your stuff, maybe money, maybe friends, maybe a spouse or sex partner, maybe a wife and children like I did. Just so you know that I'm not just blathering here, and I know personally whereof I speak. And you accept it, like our forefathers did. Now, down through the years, some of you will have come across a famous essay entitled The Price They Paid. I'm going to read you a brief excerpt. Have you ever wondered what happened to the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence? What fates befell them for daring to put their names to that document? 5 signers were captured by the British as traitors and tortured before they died. 12 had their homes ransacked and burned. 2 lost their sons serving in the Revolutionary Army, and another had 2 sons captured. 9 of the 56 fought and died from wounds or hardships of the Revolutionary War. Now, I won't go on and read the rest of the essay. You can find it on the internet, but you get the idea. You guys are going to have to get rid of this entitled white middle-class idea that it is possible to play without pay. That you can enjoy the thrills and the chills and the spills and the excitement of the game and yet never put anything on the table. Tanstoffel, as Robert Heinlein wrote, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. In order to become a political soldier of the Northwest Republic, you need to rewire your noggin. You will need systematically and brutally to suppress some bad things in your mind and your heart that have always been there, installed by the Jews. You'll have to uninstall them, or in some cases revert to an earlier version of your genetic software, so to speak. First off, you need to wrap your mind around something. It's not all about you. God almighty, the Jews have turned us white folks into such sickening narcissists. They know that the more people obsess and fill their minds and hearts with their own concerns and desires and doing what's best for them, the less room they'll have for what's best for others. The Kikes have done everything they can to sever the instinctual bond between white people, especially between white men and women. And a lot of that consists of spoiling us rotten and convincing us from childhood that the world revolves around us. There is a finite amount of love of which the human soul is capable, and the more love of self, the less love of others. A large part of the Jewish social engineering to which we have been subjected for the last few generations has been aimed at nurturing a profound selfishness and self-absorption that is one of our people's most vile characteristics. Yes, even in my generation, back in the time of abundance. It wasn't so pronounced as among today's Generation Xers and Millennials, and a few like myself managed to walk through the fire untouched, but the consumer society originated in my time, no question. Now, this self-absorption, this self-centered focus on ourselves and our own interest and welfare above all else, is probably the prime cause of our inability and or unwillingness to get our act together. The unwillingness of white people to come to one another's aid in time of racial crisis is notorious. It's legendary. How many of you listening to this have ever run into some bad situation involving nigger trouble in some public place? Most likely when you were young or in some situation where you couldn't escape forced personal contact with the primates. Now, while the booga booga booga, whatever it was going down, the one memory that sticks with you is the sight of all the white people, including able-bodied white men, leaving you to your fate against the 3 or 4 or 5 coons, shuffling their feet, sidling away, crossing the street to avoid what's going on, hastily walking or downright running for the exits so as not to get involved. Now, if you were lucky, someone might call the police for all the good that does, if they can do it around the corner where the niggers can't see them. You think it's just contemptible yellow cowardice, and to some extent, yeah, it is. I mean, remember what I said in part 2 about most of today's white boys never having been in a fight in their lives, never having received a blow from their father or anybody else growing up, and being terrified of being hit? But it's also narcissism that made those white people walk and run away from you when you needed them, and the slightest intervention on their part probably would have put a stop to it simply by evening the odds. They wouldn't help you because if they got involved, not only might they get hit or hurt, but somebody might accuse them of wicked evil racism. Someone might try to mark them as different. Somebody might come and take their stuff or their job, and their stuff and their job and their reputation in the herd is much more important than yours. Now, I deliberately included an episode like that in A Distant Thunder because of all the experiences that white boys have in high school and throughout their youth, which I've heard down through the years, that's one of the most common. It happened to me, and the shame of seeing my own people disgrace their blood and their heritage by running away from vicious animals the color of diarrhea has never left me to this day. The memory of that shame is one of the things that's kept me going all these years. Now, you need to make the decision that you will never walk away from a white boy or even more a white girl in racial trouble. You will walk toward the trouble. Not run and hide and pretend you don't see. That is the true mark of a man in Obama's America. That's the kind of man who will build the Northwest Republic. Not just decide, but when the occasion arises, you do it. You put one foot in front of the other, and you walk toward the trouble, and you take whatever comes. That's the test. That's the mark of a man. Life, the world, events, other people, the great passing human comedy and tragedy, it's not all about you. It's not even a little bit about you. You're important only as far as what you put into life, not what you take out of it. And in any case, you're just not that important at all, really. None of us is. There are billions of people on this earth, and your story is just one grain of sand on an endless beach. Now, in general, what I said is true. But I'm going to qualify that a bit here. In another sense, a moral sense, yes, it is about you, just not in the way you probably think. It's not just about what you do. It's about who you are, what kind of man you are. Bill White once wrote to me that he was convinced that it is now impossible for us ever to win, but we can and we should do everything we can to save our own souls. That, in his view, is possible. In other words, we don't go into the struggle seeking victory or prize. We go into it for the sake of the struggle itself. Now, I agree with that up to a point. I think Bill's wrong about one thing. Yes, it is possible for us to win. Hell, we could win with just a few thousand Class A white boys. That's one of the things that really bugs me. What we're trying to do here is not only possible, if we can ever get a relatively small amount of people together, organized and disciplined to the point where they'll do what they're told. This society is so far gone that it wouldn't even particularly be a hard thing to do as revolutions go. I have this vision in my mind sometime in the future of a bunch of old geezers like me, all veterans of the Northwest War of Independence, sitting around the fire with our cigars and glasses of cognac one night, whatever, we're reminiscing about the old days. And the comment that will invariably come up on these occasions is, God, I mean, I was always amazed at just how easy it was when we finally found our courage and got down to it. I mean, Jesus Christ, look at what has come out during the last 18 months alone about how this country is run, by who, and what idiots these people are. These people couldn't take it. They'd break, although the whole thing would have to be played just right on our end. I figure I got it about right in my novels. Start with 1,000 Class A's organized and positioned right, and it would take about 5 years. Maybe if I can get through to enough of you with these ghost dance talks, we can even give it a shot someday. Sorry, rambling again. That kind of self-knowledge is not only a good thing, it's essential to doing your racial duty. The innate acknowledgement that there is something in the cosmos greater than ourselves and that it asks nothing of us that is beyond our strength. Now, if we call this thing God, then we must obey it. If we call this thing duty, then we must fulfill it. Because something in us demands it. That is, if our souls are not completely diseased and atrophied. We enter this cause not because we want to get something out of it, but because we want to put something into it. We do not do what we do because we seek some kind of personal gain or advantage, either material or in the form of fame or power, or to satisfy our egos. We do this because it is right.
Through Flanders. Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing a book entitled This is Germany. Now, this is a travelogue that was written in the 1930s by Charles W. Dumblefife. And I assume that this was a journalist who was probably one of the British aristocrats. And the author wants to highlight life under National Socialism, which he does refer to as totalitarian. Now, sometimes people, especially in America, who sort of drift into the movement, say that they have libertarian ideas. That's really quite bizarre historically. At any rate, and I can't really explain why some people have that opinion, but this author looks at these organizations, and of course there were a great many, and he sees them as being brought about by geopolitics, and he notes that Germany was always much more prone to invasion than, say, England was. But he sees it as a combination of the geopolitical and also Germanic racial tendencies. He talks about how party membership is really, in a sense, earned by service. And the author talks about a quote from Adolf Hitler when he said that the most important work of the Reich was not roads or bridges, although those were certainly to be had, but it was a striving for an increased birth rate and ultimately with an eye towards eugenics. Now, this author discusses marriage loans, and these loans would encourage matrimony and families, and they also supported various home good type businesses because these loans were really typically given in the form of coupons. And this was done because there was a concern that if you gave people that had been previously poor a lot of money, they might misspend it. So they wanted to direct this consumption of goods. Also, there was a reordering of certain jobs. There were some factory jobs that were deemed really unsuitable for women, and these were given to unemployed men. Women who would be relieved of such jobs would then become involved in various other projects, depending on where they were in life. They might become involved in land year service. They could be trained as welfare workers in some cases. And very often, they also began to prepare for motherhood and marriage, and they were schools for the instruction of motherhood at that time. Now, in terms of eugenics, individuals could be classed as unfit, fit with stipulations, and fit. Truthfully, the author notes that only a few would be classed as unfit and that they would receive a degree of sympathy, but the regime really wanted to invest in individuals where it was a good investment for the society as a whole. Now, individuals who were thought to be fit with stipulations, and these were often individuals who had some sort of health condition, or maybe it was something they grew out of in childhood, or maybe something more lasting. And they were given certain accommodations so that they might fit into society as best as possible. Now, there were many work projects. Just like the WPA in America, there were many work projects, such as the Audubon, of course. And also, perhaps you would be surprised to hear this, but reclaiming farmland from the sea. So also, much like the Dutch, creating usable land. And of course, there was always that concern about the size of Germany, the size of arable land, and the desire to increase production. They were also very interested in stressing the beauty of work and the love of work. And so, for example, things like lighting in factories and the overall conditions of factory work. All in all, individuals were encouraged to reach their highest potential. And for example, after your public service completion, which could be completed in many ways, there were educational scholarships. This was a society that really wanted to reward potential in every case. And this wasn't only educational opportunities and advancement potential for men, but women could also receive scholarships and were encouraged to study in some cases, but it depended on an individual's aptitudes. Now, the author also talks about the Ordensburg and how they were used for leadership training, and really stresses that this was a society where everyone got involved. For example, elderly people without children were allowed to take on a child that may need companionship, and they would provide attention and gifts. Also, the author talks about the famous Winter Help Fund. This was a fund that went on from October to March. And again, this was given more in the form of goods and services and not so much in the form of money. The author even notes that during these days, young children would write long letters to Hitler. This was because they loved him very much. He talks about how youngsters would spend about 12 years in school. Boys would spend 11 years in school and then 6 months of labor and 2 years in the military. Whereas after 12 years of school, girls often went on to various motherhood instruction schools. So this book is a slice of daily life in this series of various organizations. This book really makes clear the fact that National Socialism was a totality that was involved in every aspect of life. Now, of course, if you want a more detailed view of the social programs under the Reich, and you want to learn all about that in more specifics, I would suggest the Tedder book, the one titled Hitler's Social Revolution, and I talked about that some years back. So this was a society that tended to subsume all interests into itself. So it's a good overview, but of course you should check out Tedder's book if you want more details. So I thank you for listening to this discussion. Have a good evening and hail victory, comrades.
I kicked around the idea of whether or not I was going to get into this last part at all, because there's a chance that some of you may simply think I've gone cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, and a few others who might think I'm blaspheming against Jesus or Odin or Yahweh or whoever, which is not my intention. Oh, what the hell, let's live dangerously. Now, I've been talking about moral duty here, and that's kind of hard to do without mentioning religion, which I normally never do at all, and which I will do now only in the most brief and tangential of ways. Although this isn't something I even consider to be religion, it's just a form of natural science we don't understand yet. Look, the primary way in which narcissism and screw you, Jack, I've got mine, and refusal to engage in the real world as you find it have always been justified among human beings is this standard excuse that Well, it's my life. It's the only one I've got. And so it's my right and my responsibility to myself to live only for myself and accumulate all kinds of money and inject all kinds of booze and drugs into my body and have all kinds of sexual hijinks with women and men and Filipino prostitutes and animals and McCormick Reapers, because you only go around once in this world. Well, no, you don't. You actually go around quite a few times. Now, I am not trying to preach or convince anybody or found a new religion or anything like that. It's just that I happen to know this is the case. I don't believe it. I know it, if you follow the difference. Through an accident of circumstance long, long ago, I learned that we live multiple lives on Earth. That's just the way it is, and you folks may believe me or not, as you choose. You want to think I'm full of it or I'm playing with a deck of 51, that's fine. It doesn't matter what you believe. You can not believe in the ocean if you like, but if you fall into it, you're still going to get wet. Hey, it's not like we're not all going to find out eventually, right? Now, as to the finer points of this cycle of repeated existence, whether it is eternal or just long, where it begins and where it ends, the whole karma thing, and to what degree this is a process of nature, and to what degree there is a guiding purpose and intelligence behind it. Now, there I see all kinds of room for debate and speculation and research, and sometimes I'll spend an afternoon or an evening online dabbling in such things, but that's about it. I do believe that with some few exceptions, our purpose in this life is to be living and dealing with this life, not concerning ourselves with the next. Now, you don't have to believe in any of this, but the fact is that I know and I behave accordingly, and so this is how I see this whole issue we're talking about here as to why you people all need to put your personal considerations aside and get with the program. There is no vengeful God who is going to punish you for hating nignogs or whoever, and yeah, you do get multiple second chances. And I'm telling you guys this now because it might help some of you make that decision that you're not going to do all this Obama American crap, and you're going to hit the reset button in your soul and take yourself back a century in the spiritual sense. You should have no real difficulty in recovering the mind and heart and soul of your great-grandfather because you were around back then as well. You just don't remember. Depending on how Zen or New Agey or Harry Potter you are, you don't just come into this world and begin a new life and then bebop on through it with no purpose, although God knows millions on millions of people seem to be doing just that. Question is, are they supposed to be doing it? I don't know. Anyway, I take the view that, karmically speaking, this life we're in now, this is a work day. We are here for a purpose, which is to restore the balance to the cosmos by serving the 14 words, securing the existence of our people and the future for white children, and making sure that the white race, which is such a vital part of the cosmic plan, whatever it is, never becomes extinct. Now, most of you have doubtless had lives in the past and will have more in the future, wherein you could live for your own personal pleasure and your own personal spiritual growth, all that New Age moo, kind of spiritual weekends that were made for Michelob. I kind of envy people who seem to be having lives like that, but this life is not one of those, at least not for me, and I think not for you. Like I said, this is a work day. The incarnation cycle is sometimes referred to as a school to which we return lifetime after lifetime in order to learn and grow. Now, if that's true, then this life is a school day, most likely the cosmic equivalent of an exam day to see if we can rise to the challenge. Now, I'm convinced that the Jews are the work of another source of cosmic creation, different from who or what created us, and different also from who or what created niggers and Asians. And the Jews were put here by that source deliberately to interfere with everybody else's development, to do us harm and to kill us off if they can. Or maybe our Creator put us here so that we could kill them off eventually. I have no idea, and I'm not worried about it. But in this life, this existence, we're supposed to be concentrating on the task at hand, which is to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. To me, those 14 words are not just something David Lane said in a courtroom. They are today's work order. They're what I've been assigned to do this time around, and what a hell of a lot more of you have been assigned to do, but those damn kikes have turned your brain to tapioca pudding with their damned electronic screens, and now you're wandering the earth like zombies. I wish to hell you'd all snap out of it and come up here and give me a hand, because we haven't got a whole hell of a lot of time left.
I was a highwayman, along the coach roads I did ride, with sword and pistol by my side. Many a young maid lost her baubles to my trade. Many a soldier shed his lifeblood on my blade. Bastards hung me in the spring of 25, but I am still alive.
I was a sailor, I was born upon the tide, with the sea I did abide. Sailed a schooner round the Horn of Mexico, I went aloft to furl the mainsail in a blow. And when the yards broke off, they say that I got killed, but I am living still.
I was a dam builder, crossed the river deep and wide, where steel and water did collide. Place called Boulder on the wild Colorado, I slipped and fell into the wet concrete. They buried me in that great tomb that knows no sound, but I am still around. I'll always be around and around and around.
Across the universe divide, and when I reach the other side, I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again, or I may simply be a single drop of rain. I will remain, I'll be back again and again and again and again.
Hello, and welcome to In Pursuit of Clarity, episode number 37, entitled Bought Men. I've used this phrase on several occasions in the past, and will certainly use it on many more in the future. And because I've not really had a chance to elaborate on how I'm intending to use it, and because I think the concept or idea or thought framework will be ever more important in the coming months and years, I wanted to use a cast to speak to all of this. Our nation, and the vast majority of the modern world, is now ruled by forces that make use of an administrative class that might justly be called bought men. Errand boys, essentially. Carrying out any action that might help them climb whatever ladder it is they're seeking to climb. This doesn't mean they're approached with suitcases full of cash in smoke-filled rooms and told something like, "You helped me do X and Y evil things, and this money is yours," because this isn't how the world works. And the process of co-opting and controlling powerful individuals wouldn't be nearly as effective if it completely lacked subtlety. Most people, even in our incredibly corrupt and degenerate age, wouldn't feel comfortable with doing something they knew for certain to be 100% wrong, immoral, unethical, or obviously destructive, solely for financial gain. It helps immensely to provide them with some excuse, some plausible deniability, some philosophical framework that allows them to seem to be doing something virtuous, at least as far as public perception is concerned. To give an example, most decent people wouldn't be comfortable with passing numerous laws and regulations, making the lives of poor people in rural communities vastly worse, more trying and more difficult. But if these poor people are white, and you're able to convince the individual with power or influence that all white people are privileged, regardless of their living conditions, and that they descend from generations of deeply evil people and likely have intentions to continue this tradition, you've provided them with a reasoning they can grasp and hold on to, making the process of buying them vastly easier. So when I use the term bought men, I almost always mean it in the very broadest sense of the word imaginable. This might be best defined as someone compelled to do anything they know deep down, at least in the recesses of their subconscious, isn't wholly right or good or just, in exchange for any form of personal gain. This would encompass anything from a politician pushing critical race theory or racial quotas for university admissions, despite non-Jewish whites being by far the least represented racial group relative to academic performance, to someone at a cocktail party with finance men and Hollywood execs choosing to give voice to ideas they're uncomfortable with because they know if they fail to play the virtue signaling game, their ascent up the social and career ladders would be essentially barred accordingly. And I think this latter example is key. Because our media and social media is now so completely monopolized, and population and wealth centers like New York or LA or Seattle or San Francisco are equally controlled, it can seem as if the entire power structure now shares singular political and cultural beliefs. And of course, this was the entire goal of this monopolization. The only means and methods by which an incredibly small percentage of the population might wield near total power, and use this power to make it seem as if the entire nation shared their views. Anyhow, because of this monopolization and its psychological effects, especially on those individuals most aggressively questing after money or credentials or awards of any sort, people feel compelled, almost invisibly, toward finding some justifications to both hold and express the beliefs of those who can grant them these things. It's similar to the idea of wanting to please your boss, but on a macro level. A clean and direct example of this mindset and behavior might be best illustrated by picturing a foreign superpower, let's use China as an example in this case, were to actually somehow overrun the nation. Not necessarily with troops and tanks, but through the purchasing of our foremost politicians, media institutions, and businessmen. Now, picture the separate camps that might develop within the nation. One would be incensed and eager to fight this foreign force at all costs. The other, believing they recognize which way the winds are blowing and how to best, quote, get ahead in an individual sense, meaning make money or receive praise and pats on the head from the occupied press, would immediately become the most enthusiastic collaborators, more than willing to sell out their nation as long as the price was right. And again, I'm using price very broadly here. The rewards may not always be immediate financial gains. Every remotely healthy system of governance has been created with an eye toward keeping these types in check and far from offices of power and influence, for obvious reasons. You simply can't maintain a nation if they should somehow rise to prominence. In fact, up until around the end of World War II, fighting for the best interests of your nation and its citizens was at the very top of the list of the attributes we sought in filling positions of power. Since then, we've let our guard down, to put it mildly, and the television-watching public has since been reprogrammed, especially in America, to adopt notions representing the inverse. So aggressive was this push, in fact, that it led to the McCarthy hearings and the sudden recognition that nearly all of those personalities responsible for our entertainment, quote, programming, seemed to be of a relatively singular ethno-religious background and ideological affiliation, despite there being such a minority of the overall population of the nation. The McCarthy hearings turned into a bit of a circus and were, of course, savaged and mocked by media and academia to prevent such a thing from ever happening again. And in the following decades, this wholesale subversion of the nation kicked into overdrive, culminating into the situation we're faced with today. I've had people reach out to me regarding their experiences in major movie production or publishing houses, and though I think most of you listening know things are bad, I don't think most of you would have any idea just how bad, how extreme these dynamics have become. Imagine you were an aspiring author, having spent all your life dreaming of writing something successful and worthwhile, perhaps something healthy and edifying, devoting the bulk of your time and energy and education to this goal. And now you're confronted with this situation. A huge percentage of the population in this scenario would compromise themselves to varying degrees, at least in avoiding speaking about subject matter you know these powerful individuals might disagree with, but perhaps even proactively writing the types of material you know would provide you with the best chance of being published. And this is why I consider the concept of bot men to be such a foul contagion, such an epidemic, threatening to destroy nations and cultures. Art, beauty, the very conceptions of merit and competence. If you choose to put your head down and play this game, and find some form of mental gymnastics that allows you to do so without feeling like a self-serving Benedict Arnold, you essentially become a small tendril of this octopus-like monstrosity, using money as its foremost tool to reshape culture, to disempower its foes, and work towards total centralized control. You seamlessly become part of this larger army, fighting against nature, against the good and the true. You may be a suitably low-level recruit, allowing you to pretend as if it doesn't much matter, even if the ideas you're embracing are wrong, unjust, or unhealthy. But it does matter. Immensely. Every individual that takes this route doesn't simply help strengthen this objectively dark force, but they also serve to further normalize the behavior in the eyes of others. This is one of the many reasons I've spoken so negatively and so often about money. The more deeply one is caught in this net, believing happiness and fulfillment might be found down these paths, the more they inevitably become controlled entities, almost without exception. There are several novel solutions to this problem, and the prospect of developing new currencies is foremost among them. But to avoid digressing, until these solutions are found and implemented, serving the dollar should be seen as the most negative and destructive of behaviors. It's always difficult to discern how conscious and willful most of these bot men are with regard to the ramifications of their behavior. It might be argued that most people are wired very simply. They want to, quote, succeed by whatever metric the majority of the population uses to define that term, and are largely apolitical and agnostic on all of these issues. Studiously ignorant, you might say. How can they be blamed if they can't recognize the negative role they're playing or just how dark these forces are to which they're compromising themselves? And this is the type of question that makes this most difficult. How much can you ever blame someone who's simply been duped? In my opinion, the reason this blissful ignorance doesn't absolve them of guilt is because our first responsibility as human beings, especially now, in these heady, dishonest times, is to cultivate some fundamental understanding of the world we live in, and this includes understanding the nature and the machinations of those who play a leading role in pulling the strings. There's simply no excuse for living on autopilot in this regard. If you're giving active or passive voice or support to ideas that will, without any doubt, make your children's lives fundamentally worse than your own, more chaotic, confused, depressing, not to mention vastly more cheap and hollow and degenerate and violent and unsafe, a portion of the inevitable fallout of all of this is on your hands. You were a willful collaborator, one who chose the path of least resistance, of wealth or power or celebrity, over your nation and its future, over health and decency and the natural order and nature herself. There's no amount of money or toys in the world that wipes this stain away. And you'll notice what a huge percentage of those most prominent figures that take these paths seem deeply unhappy. They're essentially chasing phantoms and neglecting time-tested fundamentals. A significant percentage are also childless, interestingly enough, which certainly has to contribute to this particular brand of short-sighted greed. This epidemic of the purely self-serving, acting in self-interest regardless of the larger costs in the longer term, traces back to the same root of so many of the other problems we're currently facing. Our nations are no longer fit to be called by this label, according to the long-standing definition of the word. They're not treated as, or operating in the manner of, communities with strong kinship or cultural ties, but rather like airports or shopping malls or refugee hostels. Nations are becoming essentially meaningless, and virtually nobody feels a strong sense of cohesiveness or brotherhood with his fellow countrymen. This profound shift in mentality affects nearly everything with regard to the mentality and outlook of the average citizen, and is the upstream cause of the majority of the ills positioned to end this grand experiment. And there's no longer any easy fix. Hopelessly corrupt politicians and corporate leaders have imported tens of millions of voters and cheap laborers to suit their own ends, to the extent that nobody can be blamed for wondering what, if anything, it now means to be an American. And all of this is likely to get much, much worse before it gets better, specifically with regard to the theme of this cast. Being a wholly compromised and controlled individual, blindly serving the hand that feeds them without understanding or caring to understand the broader ramifications, has now been normalized, even cheered and encouraged. The coming years will be defined by this split between those that serve their own immediate self-interest and those that find reason enough to choose to serve higher ideals. On the upside, I couldn't think of a more clean and helpful delineation and separation between two types of humanity that would be well served to walk separate directions. How this will manifest exactly remains to be seen, but when it does, I have no doubt that those on our side of the fence will be thankful they allied themselves to higher principles and took the road less traveled. Thanks for listening.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end. No safety or surprise, the end. I'll never look into your eyes again.
All right, well, that's about all the time we have this week. Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front. You can reach the party on our website at northwestfront.info. If you have any questions or comments that you'd like to have addressed on air, feel free to drop us an email at radiofreenorthwest@protonmail.com. We'll talk to you again next week. And until then, hail victory, comrades.
soon.